Hello, everybody, and welcome to You Go Take the Space. And I'm your host, Janet Carolyn Samuel. I have Paul Bichek and Leslie Hillman here with me today. I can't read their bio and what they're about because I'm not sure how to do that. But I'm going to let them introduce them and let them tell you about who they are and what they want to talk about today. So I'll start with Paul. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so can you give us a short bio on yourself, who you are, and what this show is about today?
Sure. I was born in Italy. I came over to the United States with my parents when I was 3 years old. We lived in Chicago for a couple of years, then we moved to the suburbs and stayed in that suburb of Beverly Hills for a long time until I joined the service in 1982. But before that, I got my degree in architecture from the University of Illinois at Chicago. So after graduating, I joined the service, became a second lieutenant, and I was in the service until 95, where I got out as a senior captain. Then with my architecture degree and license, I worked around Chicago in various firms, always improving my my level of acumen and increasing experience to the point where I was a principal level architect at the last firm that was at before I joined back into the government with the United States Army Corps of Engineers, and that was in 2012. And since then, I had been here away from Chicago in West Virginia, working in Virginia with the Corps of Engineers. There had been a lot of experiences that I had throughout my life that were impactful in my role in writing the novel, the first novel that I wrote, which is called Disclosure Paradox. And it really starts out, first of all, that the novel is almost autobiographical, pseudo-autobiographical, because if I were to make a memoir of my life, it really would be boring. So what I did is I took the major experiences of my life that impacted me to write the book and to reveal the link between the extraterrestrial phenomenon and our human spirituality, and to try and bridge the gap between science and religions. And so over a decade, starting with around 2009, really was where a lot of the information that is in the book happened to me. But I also had some experiences when I was a child, not being comfortable with being taught the Catholic religion, having interest in science fiction and space travel, and learning about Chariots of the Gods and Eric von Däniken. And then fast forward to when I was a lieutenant in the Air Force, actually captain, I discovered a secret basement in one of the facilities that I was inspecting, and looking further, it held a cryogenic chamber. So that was a major, I guess, event that put me towards this, this direction. And then starting with 2009, I had all kinds of experiences.
I wanted to talk about that cryogenic chamber.
Yeah, sure.
We can go back to it, but I want to make sure we do. So let's put a big note on that. Okay, so your book is called, what's your book called again? Disclosure Paradigm or Paradox? What is it?
Right.
Which one? Paradox?
Correct.
Left paradigm. Okay. And okay, and so I wanted to, before we get into great detail, okay,
yes.
So this is about your personal journey. Now, how does that tie in with Leslie?
All right, so...
And Leslie, you should bring Leslie on, yeah.
Okay, so over the decade, I not only had experiences, but I met from some very interesting people. A lot of people that were psychic, and I also had a blog, and I was in the blog I was saying about the things that were occurring to me, the spiritual things, experiences. I had a psychic woman that I had as my mentor, and she would be getting transmissions. And transmissions were for me, so she would be sending transmissions in a trance and telling me these things. And so what I did is I took all that stuff that happened in a decade and I condensed it into a dynamic 2-week cross-country journey where the main character goes through a self-awareness and becomes not only a physical journey across the country, but a spiritual journey. Now, Leslie makes the book work because I base a character on Leslie in the novel. The character's name is Katrina, and Leslie is, you know, one of the interesting people that I met in my life, and because she has such amazing abilities and things that occurred to her were extraordinary. I fit her into the novel, and she's a very, I guess, impactful part of the plot because without Leslie, the whole plot doesn't work. So I'm very thankful that she allowed me to use her to base my character. And because of her, we're also working on a prequel, which is all about her.
Oh, okay, great. So let's introduce Leslie. Leslie's just coming in to us by phone today, but and then we'll go kind of back and forth and you guys can tell us this story, this amazing story. So Leslie Hillerman, welcome to our show, and tell our
viewers
a little bit about yourself.
Well, aloha and mahalo. Thank you for having me. Well, I'm not all that interesting.
I read you on the floor. You're interesting.
Well, I don't have any degrees. I did go to college, but I have 0 degrees. And I am a housewife. I've had numerous and various jobs. And one of the most more interesting ones was working for Bionetics as a test subject out there at NASA Ames Research Center. And I received training as a psychic remote viewer from Dr. Angela Thompson Smith in 2003. And even before that, I was involved in an experiment involving several test subjects. Pretty much primarily, I believe it was United States Air Force and CIA. And that's when I found out that I had abilities that I could use that were basically on steroids. And that's where I discovered my abilities. I did have them somewhat before, but they weren't as prominent as they were in 1991, 1992. And I can kind of explain how that happened. But anyway, that sums up my career. I am still a housewife. So I always say, I'm just a housewife.
Housewives are wonderful. I guess part of me is a housewife. Part of me is an author, and you know, we're very complex people. We have a variety of parts.
All right,
so then
yeah.
I thanks for coming on, and we're going to somehow get this story conveyed between the three of us here. So, Paul, I'm very interested in, I like extraterrestrial stuff. So what was in the cryogenic chamber? And then we're going to start with the beginning, because I just want my question out of the way.
Okay.
What was in the cryogenic chamber, and where was that? What part of the world?
All right. First of all, the way I discovered the secret basement was doing my job as an inspector for construction. And the facility was called Foreign Technology Division Headquarters. So Foreign Technology, obviously by its name, their mission was to research, evaluate weapon systems from all over the world, including our own, looking at the threats, the strengths, the weaknesses, and the opportunities for these weapon systems. And then what they would do is they would make reports on existing weapon systems and make recommendations to our research and development branch of the Air Force, which was across the highway in Area B, where they would develop and conceive weapon systems to take advantage of the weakness of our opponents or to improve upon our own weaknesses based on their strengths. So in that building was surrounded by motion detectors all around. Even with a top secret clearance, an individual had to get an escort. The place that I had to check out was the entire second floor of this building, which was a two-story warehouse, no windows, a metal building. And when you go in, everything is white. The floor is white, the walls are white, the doors, frames, and the corridors are wide for three golf carts to go through side by side. And every door had a lock. There were no room numbers, no door numbers, no names. There was no directory. So whoever was in one door did not know what was going on in the next door. That's how it was. That's called compartmentalizing. Anyway, my project was upstairs, and we gutted, we had the contract to gut the entire second floor. So what was left was just the frame and, just the bare minimum of the building, you know, wires for and temporary lighting and such. Going up there with my escort, I looked at what's called our as-built drawings, and the as-built drawing is a document that indicates the building as it is at the time that you would start a project. So that's what it means, as built. And looking through it, I realized that one sheet said basement. And normally warehouse buildings don't have basements. So, and I remember not seeing any, you know, stairways or anything to a basement. So it intrigued me, and I thought this was a misplaced sheet, but I looked at it and the footprint matched the footprint of the building. So obviously it was valid. And curiously, I turned the page and I saw a enlargement of part of the basement and indicated cryogenic chamber, and measured about 7 by 90 feet. And with that, I realized that I was looking at some very sensitive information that should not have been there. Looking at my escort didn't notice that I saw what I had in my hands, and I immediately understood what was going on, and I rolled it up and made it look like I didn't open the drawings. If I were to call attention to that, there would have been a major investigation, and it probably would have impacted me. So I preferred not to do that. So I put two and two together, and if you think about foreign technology and you see a huge cryogenic chamber, well, it must mean something where it's for exotic things. And so I didn't see what was in the cryogenic chamber, and I didn't see the chamber itself, but it certainly was proof that it was there. And later on, when I read a book called Day After Roswell by Phil Corso, one of the chapters, he mentions the location and that they shipped the cadavers to, and location matched where I was. So that was validated by Phil's book.
Are they still there? Or I think that location was only used for a while, and then they got relocated again. But do you have any indication they're still there?
No. I went on Google Earth recently when I was doing research on my novel, just to look at it, because I wanted to get some more description on it, and it's gone, and there's no trace of it. It's a parking lot right now. It doesn't even look like there was a building there. They did a very good job of removing everything, and it's interesting because they spent a lot of money on that as recently as 1990. So, I don't know where that function is right now.
Yeah, I had a whistleblower yesterday say the same thing. They moved to a certain address, and they moved away, and they took everything. They took the post office box, they changed the whole road, took the whole building, no sign of it. And so when they, whoever they are, don't want something to be there, they remove all evidence.
The interesting thing is if you do a search on the number of the building, which is it was building one, area A, in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, there's no information on the internet, nothing.
Right.
It's like it never existed.
Okay. So that got your interest going. So let's go. What was the first thing that inspired you to go down this direction? You said Chariots of the Gods. That was in the 60s. Firsthand, or did you find it later? Because I saw the Chariots of the Gods and all those specials by what was his name, Rod Serling, the narrator. And they're all about the Von Daniken books in the 60s. I was born in 54, so I was a young person, teenager. So that sparked my interest. I started reading those books back then.
Right. So Eric Von Daniken was talking about specifically how the Bible had a lot of information there that, if you looked at it literally, described either contact or visitation or high technology that wasn't properly interpreted by less sophisticated individuals. Mm-hmm. And the I guess the biggest one, and the one that they were talking about when I was listening, was the entire chapter by Ezekiel, where he talks about the craft, the vision, the sound. I mean, it was very descriptive. And when I heard that, it really opened my mind about looking into that myself. And I did. The next day, I went to the library and I looked up that chapter in the Bible. Sure enough, it was there. That it wasn't it wasn't made up. So I kept that in my mind, and then of course I had the experience with the Air Force, and then what really, I guess, started me on going in the rabbit hole was come home one time from work and going to the TV, and Ancient Aliens was on, and sure enough, they were talking about the Book of Ezekiel, and it all came back to me, including my mm-hmm. experience in the military, and I decided to just start doing a lot of research, and I was doing all kinds of research. I got involved in looking at alternative energies and you know, the suppression of energy from the big oil corporations, things like that. And the more and more I got into that, the more I found other things. Then it led me to spirituality and, you know, our chakras and meditation. And that's really when things started to happen. When I started to meditate, it was like something activated in me. And I had all kinds of experience. I was meeting people that were telling me that they were psychics, that I had something special about myself. And that's where that decade starts.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I too have had a spiritual activation. Like, I'm not going to go into my story, but yeah, I started having a Kundalini awakening, which is your chakra activation. So then that leads to, well, I had several near-death experiences. So there's usually something that gets the person to go on the journey, you know, like Bilbo Baggins had the ring and visibility. So we all,
sure.
You found the chakras, and I had a similar event. So, okay, so let's go into the story and how it relates to you, and then how it comes lesbian.
All right. Well, as I mentioned, it's like an autobiography, except I don't use my name, and none of the all the characters are based on real people, but I don't use their real names, including Leslie's, to protect them. And it's essentially, like I said, it's a 2-week dynamic cross-country journey where the main character is a ufologist, and he has a failed presentation. His interest was on what I would call interterrestrials, not extraterrestrials. So the evidence that there are beings that actually cohabitate on Earth with us. And so there are four, instances where he briefs and presents to like a MUFON group, and he gets challenged about evidence, and he reveals that he didn't go to certain places, and that starts him off into a little bit of depression, where he meets a second main character, which is Mary Ellen Velarde. Mary Ellen is a psychic woman. She's a Hickory Apache woman. She befriends him. And Mary Ellen is really based on three or four spiritual women that I know. I combined their characters into Mary Ellen. And so through Mary Ellen, she convinces him to go with him to Dulce and to, with her to go to Dulce and to Mount Shasta, because those are the areas that he was interested in. And they set off. And chapter by chapter, they meet special people that helped them out towards the final journey. I could go through the characters if you want.
Yeah, I'm just gonna let you flow with the story, because I haven't read it. So tell us what's relevant about each chapter and people and how this unfolds.
All right, so
and if you have any visuals, I think you figure out how to share a screen. If you need to do that, let me know. Do you need to share your screen at all?
No,
or
I'm fine.
Just talking about it. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, Marianne Velarde is an Apache Jicarilla woman. She's an orphan. But she works at Dulce, New Mexico she's a social worker, but she's also spiritual and psychic. And then she has a mentor. Her name is Ann Stoneburner, and Ann is really based on the woman that was doing the transmissions with who I call the watchers. So these watchers would communicate with her, and she would go into a trance and type all kinds of stuff on the computer and send it to me, not knowing what she sent until she read it back. And I use those messages in the book to explain the messages that I got. Then
what's
there's
the most relevant message you got? What's the most relevant message that you got?
Well, as I mentioned, there were many psychic women that were telling me that there's something special about me, but they wouldn't go into detail. The woman that I based Ann Stoneburner on, my mentor, through the watchers, they gave me a little more detail. First, I would ask, okay, you know, I don't know what I need to do. What am I doing? And they say, just keep doing what you're doing. Well, I was doing my blog at that time, and so it appeared that I was doing right. And then they told me that I was to be a counselor and informer. Nothing more than that. Not a warrior, not anything, not a leader, just a counselor and informer. So with that role that I did the blog, and then later on I did the book. And they would tell me other things. They would confirm, for instance, the work done by Robert Dean. Do you know who Robert Dean is?
Oh, I know Bob Dean. Yeah, I love him. He's just an amazing person.
So they confirmed.
I met him another time, too.
They confirmed all the things that he was talking about our spirituality, about our flaws, about our DNA. And they were telling me the same thing, that, you know, we are spiritually corrupt, we are barbaric, we are violent, and we are under a quarantine. And the reason that we're under a quarantine is, you know, disclosure is not going to happen, because if disclosure were to happen, then you would have a technical transfer. And with a technical transfer, because of the way we are, especially being greedy and, you know, corporations being what they are, they would eventually take the technology, weaponize it, and use it against those that gave it to us. So that's why we are under quarantine. That's where we're not allowed to have official contact. You know, there may be some...
What about the stories of Roswell and the contact we've had at Dulce? Did you build those into the story? If you mentioned the cryogenic chambers, which might have been the... Because we've already had some technical exchanges, and we've reverse engineered a lot of it.
But okay, so some elements are not following that protocol, because mm-hmm. you know, they have a nefarious agenda with us. Then there are other elements out there that, you know, just because you would see a ship doesn't necessarily mean may be aligned with a certain federation or a what we would call a country. They could be, you know, like pirates. They could be rogue, and they could do mm-hmm. you know, be doing what they want, and doing it in an illegal manner. So we really don't know all that stuff, and we shouldn't assume that every race out there behaves in the way that we would, you know. Mm-hmm. So Dulce, I have Dulce in there because Dulce is actually a joint base with the reptilians, and it's not our government, It is the military-industrial complex, who has so much wealth and power that they have their own army, their own mercenaries, mm-hmm. and it's the mercenaries that are used, that we think are really military or our CIA or whatever. It's not our government. It's the military-industrial complex. And back when Eisenhower was supposed to meet with extraterrestrials at Holloman Air Force Base in 54, mm-hmm. that's where things fell apart, because they had pre-existing, you know, requirements. He didn't like the requirements. He left, but what was remained were the military-industrial complex, the corporations, and they made the agreements with those entities, not our government. And that's why things are the way they are. So getting back to the characters, right? I have Deborah Swift, who is a U.S. Air Force security police veteran. Kaia Jorgensen is based on a real person, an autistic woman in her mid-50s who is also an artist. Colonel Gerald McGeorge, U.S. Army, is a real U.S. Army colonel that came to me and revealed to me all kinds of things about his spirituality and visitations that he's had. Katrina Herman is Leslie, and Tara Everly is a senior airman stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, who's a radar specialist based on a real person. And finally, Trevor Hugo is a hybrid, a real person again, and he helps out at the end with our group in escaping a military installation. So there's a lot of action. In fact, it's very popular with the special forces. That's what at least Leslie tells me. And there's a lot of detail that, you know, you would read in a Tom Clancy novel, but there's a lot of subplots too that intertwine and make the book more entertaining. And it's gotten good reviews. So the disclosure paradox, as I mentioned, you know, disclosure cannot happen until we actually change ourselves, because it is our DNA that makes us barbaric, violent, having a irrational obsession with possessions, and being spiritually corrupt. And that is really what is our original sin, not what the Christians say what original sin is. So it's our DNA. And only when we recognize that that's the problem that we have, can we actually fix it. We can't fix it if we don't recognize it and admit to ourselves that we have that problem. Everyone, you know, one of the other, you know, problems is that we are inherently racist and to the point of being genocidal. And people think that it's a learned behavior, and it's not. And because people say it's a learned behavior, they think it'll go away, and it won't. We have to admit that we are that way, like it or not. So until we change, we will not have... we will not be part of that universal community that we would like to be part of, you know, that Star Trek utopia that, you know, we think about and we dream about. That won't happen until we actually change fundamentally who we are. And the closer...
Let me ask you something about... Yeah, I was very active in the Star Trek community, and it's still going. It's like 50 years later, and we still have Star Trek. So we have the model of how to interact with species that are not human. We have a model, but probably actually going on. So I guess I'm a little bit more optimistic, and I'm also an AT contactee. So I've interviewed, you know, hundreds of experiencers that have had direct contact with extraterrestrials. So I'm a little bit maybe more optimistic than the average person. I'm sorry, I got kicked off. I didn't realize on Zoom that if somebody called in, they can kick me off if I called into the show. So I know it kept going and you were speaking, so I missed about 5 or 10 minutes of what you were saying. So anyway, what about Star Trek? Isn't that like an effort, like a public service effort for the last 6 years to wake us up and move us past this behavior that's keeping us from being admitted to the Federation and planets?
I don't think we're there yet. In fact, we're getting farther away, not closer to that, which is evident in current events.
Right. But isn't that, I've been looking at it too, and I, you know, all this like riots and black light. We've had that in the 60s. When I was a kid, they were burning down Pittsburgh. So I walked through the smoldering remains. So it's kind of gone full circle on that. But although I think things are changing, because now when I was a kid, you put on the news and all the people were white. And now you put on the news and there's all these different colors and names, you know, different names. So it seems like we're, even though we sold the public stuff, which was spurred on by the current political situation, we still have something going on where people are becoming more and more tolerant of one another and working together. So have we made any progress in your mind? And Leslie, maybe you want to interject too, something to hear. Feel free, Leslie, to chime in and ask questions. And,
okay, thank you.
What do you think of that? Let's have a new voice.
Well, you know, as I've listened to the both of you speaking, I'm thinking that, you know, I see a polarization. Everything is beginning to be so much more clear. Those that are truly on the light side of the force are the light side of the force. Those that, you know, have been kind of hiding their corruption and evil are now in the forefront being corrupt and evil. So you're getting more of a polarity, you're getting more of a showing who's who in the stage of life, and you get an idea who the actors and actresses are. I see that happening. I was always one of those that, you know, had always believed in the higher aspect of humanity, always hoping and praying that humanity would reach some sense of a higher purpose or a higher sense. As I have traveled through this life and having to deal with some of the most unbelievably vile people on this earth, and, you know, I sit there and I go, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't realize that things were this bad. And they have technology. And that was frightening to me. It was like, oh my gosh, you know, look at the good that they can do and then look at the evil that they've done. So, you know, it's one of those things. You know, I see that and I don't know how to reconcile, you know, a future with that, because you've got the forces of light that are not going to be engaging, you know, in the forces of evil. I think the forces of evil, basically, they like to pick on each other anyway. And so,
here's an example of what of somebody you saw that was so that had. They had the technology. I'm curious, but that's stuck back there.
Well,
I'm thinking
about the experiment. Well, the experiment that I was in 1991, 1992 was a real eye-opener for me. It was so incredibly painful because a lot of the people that I knew were involved in that experiment, And a lot of the people that I knew were, I thought, really good people. I mean, you know, they were interested in all these different technologies and super bright and super helpful. I mean, going around the world, helping other countries, all this other stuff. And then to see their dark side in this experiment.
Describe the experiment again. What was the experiment with the parameters?
Well, the experiment was with electromagnetic fields. And it was basically what you would consider a mind control experiment. However, the experiment with me turned into something else altogether. And thanks to Charles Cusimano, it turned into an all-out war. But if we had not engaged in combat, I would have been 6 feet under the ground by now.
Is this going to be in the prequel, or is this battle in the current book? This experiment.
Oh no, this is. Well, the experiment might be in my book later on when I talk about it, because it was one of the most horrendous, most traumatic experiences I've ever had in my life. I mean, I've had an awful lot of trauma, but
can you give us any details? Because it's kind of cryptic. It's like, what happened?
Well,
come on, give us some details.
This was an experiment. This was an experiment dealing with electromagnetic fields, and I mean high energy fields. You're dealing with I would use the term psychotronics on steroids because
yeah,
it went beyond the normal psychotronics.
So you're using psychotronics, and then who was in the battle? Who's fighting whom? And what was your part?
Well, it was basically me versus a team. And the team was made up of medical doctors that were, you know, had CIA clearances, of course.
These were humans. I mean, were they all Americans, or were you dealing with
most of them were American. There were some that were Russian that were there. And I can't remember their names to save my life. The Russian ones. I feel the American ones.
We don't need names. We don't need names.
We don't need names.
we don't want to get anybody killed, but we just want an overview. So you're doing a psychotronic battle, and so tell us a little bit more about what was going on and why you almost got killed.
Okay. Well, with the psychotronic battle, I basically was losing all by myself. I was one person up against an entire team, and the team was working 24/7 from a laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And the laboratory was, of course, located in Nevada City, and it, you know, pretty much it included all the doctors. It included a college professor, a university professor, and his grad students. So
what were they doing to you? What were they doing to you?
Everything that they could possibly have done.
Were they making your eyeballs out of your face? I mean,
well, not that bad, but they were using cybernetics, the ability to override your central nervous system and, you know, basically use electronics to induce, you know, movement within your muscles. That is
okay, beyond your control. Moving you against your will. What would they do?
I wouldn't say totally against your will, because you can get a handle of it. You can do it. But it takes, you know, if you don't know what you're doing and you don't know what you're up against, which I didn't, but I had an innate sense of what I needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't explain how I do that. But you know, normal people, I'm not sure made it all the way through. The guy that set me up for the experiment, he told me that three had died and two were not doing too well. So I wasn't mm-hmm. sure if I was one of the two that weren't doing too well, or I was, you know, number six or seven or eight or whatever, you know, but I knew that there was more
and
than just
some of them
me.
Die and they don't stay dead. Let me tell you that what I've learned is
they die. No, yeah.
Some of them in these experiments die and they go to the rejuvenation tank and they get revived. So I've had some people come on and they say, you know, I died this way and that way and that way. And, back alive again.
Yeah, these.
Okay, just stay dead.
These,
okay.
No, I'm pretty sure these people were dead. I knew of one test subject that died. Her brain fried completely up.
Did you breathe in this experiment? But did you sign off on this experiment that you could die? And then what was the motivation for you to engage in such an experience?
Oh,
well,
the motivation was survival. The motivation was definitely survival. I found myself in this experiment. I think that what it was, you know, unfortunately, a luck of the draw, and it was bad luck for me. And, I got involved. He had said to me, he said, Leslie, you have a choice of A, dying, or B, going insane. And being me, I just said, how about C? None of the above. You know, I mm-hmm. didn't know what I was up against, but I knew that, you know, I was going to be in for something. I wasn't quite sure what, but... I went in ready for a fight, I guess, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew my body pretty well. I knew my mind very well because I had studied other disciplines. So it was kind of like, okay, you know, I know my stuff from a certain point in metaphysics. So, you know, I'm going to enter this with some sense of something. And I knew right away that I was dealing with physics. I knew right away that I was dealing with high energy fields, the electronics. It actually makes you feel, when they set up the field around you, it feels like your brain is being separated. It almost feels mm-hmm. like you've got positive ions on one side, negative ions on the other. You know, it almost seems as if it's your brain's being polarized. There's a polarized field.
Wow.
So it's a very interesting situation, but it was, you know, it was definitely different. I'm glad I made it through. Thank you to Charles Cosimano. But and then afterwards, I did get a resume from Charles Whitehouse. And at the time, I guess he had been the original founder of the U.S. Psychotronics Association, or a past president, I'm not sure which. But I had gotten a resume from Dr. Charles Whitehouse from Paradise Valley, Arizona. And it was basically his resume on what he had done with psychotronics. And he said that I called him up and he said that he wanted me to be his student, but it was going to be about $1,500.
Oh.
And at the time I was not into $1,500. I mean, I was doing good if I was looking at $10, much less $1,500. So, but anyway, he had listed what he was able to do with psychotronics that I thought was interesting. And I'd like to read that real quick for you. He had 18 years into the research into the field of psychotronics. He had developed crystalline magnetic psychotronic devices called multi-spectral image analyzer stations. He had developed psychotronic beamer devices that interfaced with satellite systems. He had taught classes in psychotronics in the use of all the multi-spectral image analyzer workstation, all phases, how to interface mind energy into matter called distant viewing, manipulation of mind energy, psychokinetic application, the science of future lecture history, etheronic energy definition, psychotronic instruments, discussion of the cyborg effect,
explanation of photobiological receptivity, aura cleansing, chakra balancing, health application, environmental applications, farming, insect pest control, geomancy, interfacing and energizing ley lines and balancing Earth's magnetic fields and warfare. And he had trained the CIA and the DIA personnel in Operation Psychotronic Devices. He sold to the Navy psychotronic device for surveillance purposes. He tracked a submarine in the Pacific with instruments on Atlantic coast through photo application and distance viewing. And then at a distance of 80 miles, using photo of a magnetron, which is an X-ray beaming device, with psychokinetic energies, he was able to break the electromagnetic beam 6 out of 10 times in a one-hour program at the U.S. Radiobiological Research Center at Bethesda, Maryland. So that was a man who wanted to train me after all this. But I couldn't afford the $1,500, and instead I went with Charles Cusimano, and we did everything through energy patterns. And boy, those energy patterns actually worked very, very effectively. And I learned how to overlay one energy pattern over another, almost creating like a 3D type of an energy pattern. And in my mind, I was able to turn that to do whatever I needed to do. And it worked probably just as effectively as any of these electronics. But Charles Cusimano and I together, we made it.
I want to pull Paul back in here. Hey, Paul, are you there? Okay, yeah. So let's see, we're at the top of 1 hour. Where do you want to go with your story in here, and how do you pull in, how do you weave you and Leslie in? So continue.
Leslie?
Yeah. How did you, how are you weaving your stories together? Because you both have fascinating stories. And
well,
we'll focus on your first book here, so the prequel will be coming next book. So
I don't know how it came to me, but all I know is that when I decided to write the book, I wrote 31 pages of outline in a weekend. In one weekend, 31 pages of outline, and I never strayed from that. And, you know, my goal was to make use of not only the information that was given to me, but to make use of the personalities and characters that I met, because they all have a lot of something to enrich the book. And I'm not sure, I think Leslie and I met online through Facebook, and I was very intrigued by her story, and I guess she kind of understood that I was genuine and that I actually cared about her experience, and her ability that I put into Katrina's character, it was essential for the team in the novel to mount a assault on Dulce, because that's what happens in the book. They actually mount a assault on Dulce, and they use Katrina. They ask her to help her out, to help them out by causing explosions on generators, on power equipment, and there's an entire chapter of how they go about planning this out, and it's in detail, very much.
Are you tying this in with the? Are you tying this in with the actual Dulce attack that happened with Mark Richards, and are you tied that in with a real event that's been reported? Or just
am I trying what?
Dulcy attack. There's a story that's in ufology about a real Dulcy attack that happened, I think it was under the Carter administration.
Oh,
and they
I remember that.
Utilized Dr. Mark Richards. I wonder if you're tying yours into that story.
Actually, I mentioned that in the novel as a talking point on existence, because one of the characters, Robert Ladd, who's a former Special Forces, one of his friends was involved in that conflict. Yeah, I have that in there, but this is actually an assault on the base, because there was a lab there where they had either hybrid or specimens from abductions. So in the mm-hmm. novel, I have two abduction stories, and you find out that Marielle Velarde was abducted, and so was the security police officer Deborah. They find out in one of the chapters that they shared an abduction, and that's when they decide. Actually, Mary Ellen always had this in her mind to go to Dulce and get her child back, and that's why they go and that in that assault they disable the installation, they cause an evacuation, and they have little time to go in and rescue the specimens, and that's what they do in the novel. So I tie in a lot of information that we got from various people through blogs, through contractors that worked at Dulce. I have all kinds of things in there describing the construction, how it was designed, where the living quarters are. I mean, it's very descriptive, and I make use of that information to put together that chapter.
Good. Okay. So where were we in the sequence of the story? Where do you want to go next?
Well, okay, so you know, Leslie is here because not only we're talking about the disclosure paradox, which we've talked about already, but I'm working on a prequel with her, and the prequel is about Katrina. And I, with Leslie's help, I've put together a plot in that which mirrors all of Leslie's experiences, her challenges, mm-hmm. the emotional strife that she went through, and it's not only an action kind of novel, but it's looking at a dark side of our humanity. And it also looks at her as not just an object of interest, but really looks at the impact emotionally, physically, and mentally on her. And I actually put the reader in her mind to let the readers understand the everything that was going on in her mind, because she started out as, and she could probably interject since it's her story, but she starts out as a very naive, benign, benevolent, innocent young woman. And because of all of this harassment, torture, and this activity on her just for the sake of, they had an interest in what they call their science, but they were really sociopaths. They were masochistic, and it changed her from being a benevolent and innocent young woman, where she actually had to be like them. She had to turn sociopathic. She actually went to the aid of a member who happened to be on her side, but was very much like them. He was a killer, an assassin, and she learned to be like him. So the story kind of has that evolution where, it's a very close inspection on the fragility of the human mind. Go ahead, Leslie. Sorry.
Yeah. I guess you could actually hear me going, oh yeah. I wanted to talk about that too, because I actually did, when I was 17, I actually was starting to be trained as an assassin. And that was no fun.
How do they sign you up for assassin school? How does that go? I mean, that wasn't the course I took in high school.
Those are one of those things where you walk into it.
I never walked into that. Tell me about it.
Well, it was one of the most bizarre things, but I was 17 years old.
Where were you raised?
I had just...
What part of the world?
Huh?
Where was this going on? What part of the world?
I know it. Well, I was 17 years old. I had just gone to San Diego State University. I had had some problems with someone that was in the United States Navy who was related to me. And I was living on my own. I got a place on my own closer to the school. And at that time, I don't even know how it happened. I walk into the store, which was basically kind of like a sandwich shop, an herbal shop. Mm-hmm. And the next thing I know, I've got this guy coming up to me saying, you know what, I've waited for you for a really long time. We've been waiting for you and we need to talk to you. And that was a little mind blowing. I wasn't exactly sure what was going on. He was with
a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, somebody said that.
Well, it ended up being a really bad thing, but he was, he had been with the United, it was called the Army Air Force in Vietnam. He was a major. He was also a pilot. He was one of those people that went through assassinating our own guys. If he found them being tortured, he would assassinate them and everybody else. He was one of those that just was not, compassion does not come to mind when you meet the man.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion was just not one of his characteristic traits or character traits. So anyway, I found out that I had psychic ability. We were working with telepathy and again, moving energy. We had learned hand-to-hand combat. What was really disconcerting and what caused me to leave was I just automatically dove right into his body. And I could feel everything from inside his body. I could see the blood vessels. I could, hear his heart. I could hear, every function of everything happening in his body. It was exceptionally loud in there. And I was never so scared in my life because I felt like I was
trapped. What was going on that you dove into his body?
I just found myself projected. It was all of a sudden I had been outside my body, and then all of a sudden I was inside his. And what was really bad is he said to me. Well, he knew. He seemed to know where I was because he said, Leslie, I want you to stop my heart. I want you to attempt to stop my heart. And I thought, oh my God, because I knew exactly right then and there what he was asking me to do and why.
Mm-hmm.
And I got frightened and I felt again like I was claustrophobic, like I wasn't going to be able to get out of this man's body to save my life. I didn't know what to do, how to do. So I just started screaming. I started screaming inside of his body. And I started screaming until I could actually hear my scream outside of his body. And as soon as I realized my consciousness was right back in my body, I took off. I just said, I grabbed my things and I said, this is it. You'll never see me again. And it was true. I believe it was a helicopter mechanic at, not at Pelham Naval Air Station, at Miramar, Top Gun, when Top Gun was at Miramar. And he helped move me back up to my parents' place up in Nevada City, California. So I was so frightened at that point that I just said, no, I can't do this. But I knew exactly what it was.
This around was this during the Vietnam War? What year was this?
This was 1976.
Okay, yeah. So was this when they were doing Men Who Stare at Ghosts? Or in that era?
Pardon me?
When they were doing... Is this the same time frame where they were doing the Men Who Stare at Ghosts? That group, or was that a little bit later?
I have no idea. I'm not sure.
Yours is a little bit later. Okay. I recommend you watch the movie Men Who Stare at Ghosts.
Yes, I have.
Some of the backstory. Okay, so that I think was in the 60s, because this is continuing in the 70s. So I had people that had been approached, but somehow they learned that you're psychic. And I don't know, maybe Paul, are they able to read somebody's soul signature and know on some way that this person is psychic?
Well, part of my guess...
How are they finding you?
Part of my guess was that my dad was military. My dad was United States Navy. He was he retired as a lieutenant commander, but he became a commander in the reserves. He was also a spy. He had been at Roswell during the crash. He had seen alien bodies. He was under surveillance by the military.
Mm-hmm.
I believe with all my heart that the children of these guys are also monitored by the same types
right.
of monitoring.
So what we're finding is a lot of these children are hybridized. They're genetically enhanced. You know, there's something about when you join the military that the kids are fair game. And I have so many people that have been enhanced and experimented with, and sometimes before they're put in the womb, sometimes the father's sperm, the mother's egg, after you're in the womb, right after you're born. So I wonder if you have any, a lot of the times the parent, well not a lot of times, sometimes the parent will confess to the child, who often has a wife like yours. Some of them are on board ship. And one was Cynthia Crawford, and she said that her dad finally confessed to her, I'm sorry. She was, they used DNA of, it was Grays and Mantis and her father's DNA. She was inserted into her mother's womb with her twin, but they were not related twins. They were like just carried in the same womb. So I wonder if you have any insight into, because, you know, you're obviously, they were expecting you. Like they said, we were waiting for you because you're part of the program. Was your father still alive?
No. No, he passed away in 1983.
Okay.
Yeah, he passed away in 1983. Yeah, I was 22 when he passed away. But, yeah.
What did he die from?
He died from... cancer that had metastasized. In his liver. Probably, it started out as lung cancer, probably.
A lot of times they don't want them to live so old so they can do a field torso book. Like you read the day after Roswell. It's like, you're not going to do that. We're not going to allow that.
Well, I think that the military has something to do with that. I think that when you're dealing with things like aliens and what have you, that you're automatically under some sort of surveillance. And I know that that surveillance probably continued with me going to San Diego State University. And I believe that, you know, that whole thing was orchestrated. I think that, you know, for some odd reason, I believe that the Navy was right behind it. Or, you know, whatever organization it is that does the monitoring was behind
the
that. And I believe it was electronic monitoring. Yeah, it was electronic monitoring.
It's all, you know, secret-based stuff. Secret intelligence.
Right.
Yeah. In San Diego.
Right.
Really big. So, were you meant to marry a certain person and have children? Because often they want you to... they kind of do a love bite thing where they direct you and you end up mating, marrying, having children by somebody who has similar abilities or something that they're wanting to enhance and have.
I actually didn't end up that way. I think that in both of the marriages that I had, that it was basically just trying to, we were both kind of, well, in the first one, we were both pretty much living, wanting to live in a utopia, which wasn't going to happen. And that didn't work too terribly well. And then in my second marriage, my husband's been so against psychic anything and psychotronics. He doesn't even want to hear it. But he's not too terribly, you know, happy about UFOs or anything else. So, you know, his world is a little different than mine. So it really wasn't that way. I don't think that had anything to do with my development. In fact, I think that what happened to me was that the more negativity I had in my life, it almost seemed like the stronger the psychic ability became, because I would have to rely upon my psychic ability for survival. Or for, you know, it's almost like being thrust into a combat situation. A lot of the vets from Vietnam said that they, you know, had found out about psychic ability in Vietnam. And they just developed that spidey sense. And I think that's what I had to do. The more negativity and the more evil that I faced in going through my life, it actually enhanced and strengthened perhaps the character traits that I wanted in my own life, you know, which would be the complete opposite of everything that was being presented to me. And then also the psychic ability became stronger, because that was not the only time that, you know, that I was going to be approached. And I think that the mind control experiment, as weirdo as it was, somebody there at that mind control experiment knew about what had happened to me in San Diego. I am so sure of it. Mm-hmm. And I think
well,
that's
interesting
what,
that you're tying in the Vietnam connection, because I dated a Vietnam vet, and he was very psychic, and that was. He actually changed my whole life. Had I not met this psychic man that was developed his abilities in Vietnam, I would not be in Hawaii and I wouldn't have met my husband. So, but it seems like on some level this stuff is all orchestrated, right?
Yeah.
Like you said, when you had the second event, it was, they knew about the first event.
Oh yeah. It was very, you know, for sure, I believe that it's been pretty much orchestrated, because, you know, how much bad can a person possibly, you know, get into their lives when you've been studying everything about the positive aspects of energy and, you know, being a light worker, bringing light and health and what have you to the planet, then all of a sudden you get hit sideways by some of the worst badass dudes in the business. And it's like, whoa, what did I do? But I think what it is maybe somebody somewhere along the way decided that maybe, you know, warfare was my thing. And maybe I needed to grow. I needed to keep on growing. I needed to keep on being put into certain scenarios to either make or break me. And then, you know, and just keep right on going with it. And I think
talked to a group of super soldiers, and there's like two or three members that have home labor on Mars. They were thrown into this deep water. The sides were just stiff. The seat, you couldn't get up. And they tested them to see if they could figure out how to use each other and survive and not drown. They all ended up drowning. Of course, they got revived. And so you don't have any memory of dying and getting revived, but this one was, you know, they're always putting you through the test. And then you somehow, you learn the lesson. So you got the lessons from all this, and it develops your abilities. So some people develop abilities, they learn to fly, so to speak. You know, when you're shoved off the cliff, you go and die at the bottom, and you learn how to fly. But we have all these natural abilities, like levitation, like, you know, psychic abilities. And some people, it activates it. You know, super heroes, right? all that potential, but something needs to activate it.
Well, I think that's what happened in 1991 and 1992, is that that junk DNA or whatever that floats around in all of us was activated. And all of a sudden, I had psychic abilities on steroids. So anytime a laboratory would hit me and they build up a field with me, well, then they have to remember that it's a corresponding field. I mean, they have to remember that what they give us, they have to remember that what they give it, they're going to have to take it, because, you know, I'm able to give it back. And so I did that in an experiment with Pakistan. Pakistan decided to hit me sideways. And, you know, it was like, okay, you know, even the psychic operator, they call them psychotronic operators. The operator even told me, he said, I'm not afraid to die. And I said, why do you think you're going to die? I have no reason to kill you, you know, yet. I have no reason to kill you. I'm not going to kill you. And basically, I took out one of their transformers at 10,000 kilometers at Abbottabad. And
right. So
I started
you
doing
some abilities, so that's why I mentioned it. Like sometimes they can come in.
Well, you know, you have to remember they set the field up around you, so it goes
right.
Two ways. It's like a two-way street. It's not a one-way street. It's a two-way street, and you can give it back to them just as good as they give it to you. You can give it back, and I took their energy and sent it right back. You know, it was like, oh, the heck with this. You know, and I did a few other things. And then that was when he threatened me. He said that he said that if you ever come to Pakistan, that he would have the CIA execute me. But so one of the things, though, that that had happened is that he had talked to one of the people that had built the laboratory there in Pakistan, in Islamabad. And he, you know, he said, oh, well, what was it like being in combat with her? And he replied, it was like being bitch slapped by a Care Bear. And I thought, whoa. Bitch slapped by a Care Bear. Okay. Yeah, well, that's cool. And wow. So I had it. Yeah, I had a charm bracelet, and so I got a Care Bear to commemorate my battle or whatever.
Are you still having this stuff go on, and then we'll go back to Paul? Are you still experiencing these things to this day? Are you still on this program? I don't think you ever believe.
I still have.
What's your script?
Well, I still have a target on my back somewhat, but I had an experience earlier this year, and I was in my living room, and I got hit, and I could feel the energy just splat right up against me, and it tingled right throughout my entire body. I mean, mm-hmm. I was sitting there going, what the heck was that? And I mm-hmm. just started laughing. I thought, what the heck? And right. I thought, I think somebody just tried to kill me. But as soon as it hit the energy pattern that I constantly wear around my neck, mm-hmm. it had hit that energy pattern and it diffused.
Right.
It just diffused all over the place. And thanks to the energy pattern, I'm up walking and talking. But I think that wow. it was definitely meant for me to be 6 feet under again. And I just sat there and went, whoa. So, yeah, I had a little bit of problem there, but other than that, that's okay. You know, it's gotta be for me. I mean, it's like, okay, so that was a pot shot, but, you know, it's just one of those things that happens, you know, and you just have to be strong. You just have to be somewhat alert, and you can't really let your guard down. If you let your guard down at any time, you know, that could be really bad news. I can't live my life the way that other people live their lives. I wish I could. I mean, mm-hmm. I wish that I could open up to love and joy and happiness sometimes, you know, and I can't. You know, I can't open up and I can't be vulnerable. You know, I can't be.
What's your life like now?
We won't talk about that.
I think you can open up to love. I don't know enough of the details. But, you know, I've been in this program my entire life too. And at one point they said you won't pass the dead in life. You know, they just want to keep this in the where they can monitor and control it. So, you know, and I guess they test you periodically. Is she still able to ward off attack? So I've heard this story from a lot of people, and it's like, you know, slight variations, but it's like there's something going on. So, Paul, in your research, have you found other people that are having similar things go on? And whenever you're talking, I just thought of like 20 things that were correlations with other people in the program or this, whatever this is that's going on. I've heard all these stories now being in the center of reporting all these stories for the last 10, 15 years. Paul, as a researcher, are you finding this a phenomenon that's happening across, or you haven't encountered it yet? Is Leslie the only one, first one? And I think this is important that you tell this story. This is important.
Yes, it is. I guess the main message is about our flaws, why we are being quarantined. Let me go back to I guess to give evidence of the. The start of the UFO ET phenomena, and that is when we exploded the atomic bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was like a fire alarm throughout the entire universe, because mm-hmm. Our scientists didn't understand that enormous amount of energy not only impacted our world, but it had an impact on other dimensions. And we don't know that. And so with that, that's why Roswell happened, because Roswell was a group of scientists coming to look and see what was happening, and they were at White Sands Missile Base, which is where we're doing a lot of our tests. So the spike in extraterrestrial activity really started after the advent of the nuclear era. So they're concerned about that because we're not spiritually advanced to handle that kind of power. Because of our corruption and because of the flaws that we have, that kind of power requires a high level of ethics and spirituality that we haven't attained yet. So they know that, and they're watching us, and they have stopped nuclear exchange many times. One being in 67, where there was going to be an accident, I believe, and there was a craft that showed up at Malmstrom Air Force Base, where they have the missiles in the silo, and one by one, each silo was shut down by this craft, and that was documented well. So the result is that the extraterrestrials know that Earth is a very important place for the universe. It is where our spirits, when they enter the human body or they link with the human body, this is where they learn about everything that makes us human, love, pain, suffering, creativity, the arts, all of that makes us, you know, gives us the human condition, are learned by the spirits. And that is why Earth is so important in the universe. So Earth is critical, but the humans aren't. And the extraterrestrials are still monitoring us because they're concerned about how we are handling the planet itself. See? So that is really the essence of why Earth is very important, and why I have added the spiritual part in the novel. But getting back to your question, yes, there are many people that have a similar kind of role. Everyone has some sort of role towards our spiritual evolution. And you don't really learn it, understand it, until you start to really become more conscious through meditation and other things. There are two individuals that the characters in the novel they do have certain roles. The colonel that I mentioned is actually what I call the divine warrior, where he was in prayer. He was given a vision of him on a battlefield, and there were beings that were not human that were attacking his ranks, and he was given the sword of Michael. There were many times that he had visions of what we call Mary, which is really a vision that is benign and is meant to kind of bring comfort to the person that is seeing it. So, you know, he's very comfortable with Mary, but it's probably an entity that is there to look like Mary. That happened also in Fatima, of course, and Lourdes. So he has been told that he has a role also. If we get to a point where we get towards what we call Armageddon, but hopefully we won't get there. We don't it just because it's in the Bible and just because it's a prophecy doesn't mean it'll happen. There are ways that we can get around it. And then the other person, Trevor Hugo, who is based on a hybrid, also has a role. So there are many, many out there. I'm sure that as time passes, people will start to meet other people that have similar roles, and they could form what I would call a spiritual army.
Okay. Well, I need to start wrapping this up. My husband came home and he's making dinner. I'm getting hungry. Let's start to do a final round here. So, Leslie, what would you like to say to our listeners?
Well, again, everyone pick up a copy of The Disclosure Paradox if you haven't. I think that it will be, you know, quite enlightening. And for me, it's quite informative. I enjoyed the stuff that I could pick out that says, yes, that's true. So mm-hmm. I enjoyed that so much. And I recognized several characters myself in there. And I was really excited. Also too, as humanity goes through our little thing, let's be kind to each other as much as possible. It's a tough world out there and it's not getting any easier. We need to lift each other up and we need to protect and really do what we can for each other on a humanitarian type of basis. I think that we are going to be going through some pretty horrendous changes, and we just need to be not blowing up bridges, but instead we should be building bridges. So that's all I have to say.
I like that. Yeah, Paul, your book, it's like in the Indiana Jones of ufology, and it'd be great to see a screenplay or something, especially if you go into the prequel and, you know, this could be two or three movies or a series, a television series. Have you thought about working up the screenplay and approaching somebody? Is it, you know, this investigator that, I guess it's like J. Allen Hynek, but bring it through all the stories made from modern times, the expert. And that in itself mm-hmm. is a way to disclose it, because a lot of these concepts are introduced through our science fiction, and nobody really has done this the way I think this book might be able to do it, and yourself, you might be able to do it. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are a couple things that when people ask me, what do you want for people to take away from the book? Well, first of all, it's meant mm-hmm. to bridge the gap between science and religion, going towards truth. And second, it links the extraterrestrial phenomenon to our human spirituality. And finally, what I say is that if you're an atheist, then consider that there are higher powers out there that you don't see and you can't touch, but they're there. But at the same time, if you're religious and you believe in those higher powers, consider that those higher powers can be explained by science. So again, that's where you converge spirituality and science, and you mm-hmm. start to get towards the truth. After I'm done with the novel that I'm working on with Leslie, I hope to start writing a screenplay on the first book, because it does have potential. And there's a couple other ideas that I have in mind. One thing that I mentioned about our scientists not knowing the impact of atomic energy on other dimensions. They know it now. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to control the event of actually breaking through dimensions. And that is why they have that CERN accelerator going on in Europe. That's the main reason for that. What they're trying to do is they're trying to open the barriers between our dimensions and gain access to it. And I think that's not a good thing. And I'm pretty sure that there are extraterrestrials out there, interdimensionals, that feel the same way.
Yeah, the whole interdimensional thing, I mean, the extraterrestrials go interdimensionally. I've seen them, they've taken me through walls and windows, so I've experienced that. And then when we die, are we going to another dimension when we leave our bodies? So that whole thing is we don't know, but I would imagine that would be very dangerous to explain with.
Well, part's in the novel, too. That part's in a novel too, because I went through an out-of-body experience, and I saw the source, and I saw the spirits between lives in an indigo kind of like a beehive of billions and billions of flashing lights that were spirits that were in one group and in one conscious energy. And as I got closer to it in my out-of-body experience, I felt that euphoria. So there's a lot of information about what happens when we pass on, and there's even a regressive activity going on in there about two past lives that I had. So there's a lot in that novel.
Sounds great. Do you have a cover, a picture of the book? Do you have the book near you that you can hold it up?
Yeah, sure. It's called The Disclosure Paradox.
Okay, go back a little bit. Hold towards you a little bit. There you go.
Yes, that's the Disclosure Paradox. If they go into the website is www.thedisclosureparadox.com, all one word. They could go in, they could read excerpts from every chapter. They could look at the table of contents. They could read descriptions of the characters. And they could read the latest reviews by other readers. And it's available on Amazon as a paperback and also on Kindle.
Well, we're looking forward to the next book and the screenplay and the movie. I'm on board. Hopefully. And I will put this link up on AquarianRadio.com. Leslie, do you have a website, anything you're promoting?
Actually, no, not yet, but I am on LinkedIn, okay. And I am on Facebook as Leslie Wilkins-Hillerman, and people can contact me there, too.
Okay, oh, yeah, wonderful. And my book has a Facebook group, too. It's called The Disclosure Paradox, a science fiction novel, and it's an open Facebook group, and we got about 273 right now in there.
Well, send me the links to everything. I'll put it on the show page, and I'll see if we get more people to sign up. Okay, well,
we'll do.
I think that's all for today. I don't have a way to do any kind of exit music, so we'll just say thank you for coming, everybody, and aloha. Much love and blessings.
All right.
Take
care. Aloha. Again,
have a good dinner. Aloha. Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Leslie.
Bye, Paul.